Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Well, let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on today, March 23rd, 2019.
Or 10-19.
Well, no, I issued a correction on that.
We were showing our newsletter was dated for 1,000 years ago, and it was immediately corrected, but we wanted to make sure that we were getting to as many audiences as possible. And the older generations have been ignored for many years, maybe even 1,000 years they've been ignored.
I just think it's fascinating.
Think of all the votes.
Yeah. As I was writing the correction, I realized the ironies of making it 10-19.
Right.
We have a caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great. This sounds like Chris.
No, this is actually Tyler from Temple. I called
Tyler.
Tyler Von Temple.
All right.
Yes, sir. Tyler Von Temple. Guys, I got to an argument with a guy on Twitter.
That's a bad idea. You have just said something that all of us could say anytime we're on Twitter.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
And what he was saying was he was a big name guy, but he was saying a bunch of stuff that weren't facts. He was saying that how can an economy that is based on consumerism and debt with no savings, and how can that ever function and stand up to anything? We're just a house of cards, blah, blah, blah. So,
well, he's wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I started spitting some facts at him, like the 7.6% savings rate that you guys mentioned last week. And then it also got me to wondering, okay, how much of our economy is actually made up of it comes from consumerism, like growth coming from consumerism? And that number is kind of high, right? It's 69%.
Yeah. 69-70 kind of wobbles around.
Yeah, and that's a really good thing, by the way.
Yeah.
But
all right, let me
hang on.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead and finish your question.
Last thing, I just want to say I was super surprised to learn that only, according to the San Francisco Fed, only 11% of that is from imports, is actually consumption on imports. So most
That's
of
right.
the consumption is done from U.S. goods.
That is
right.
correct. If you look at our trade deficit or even our imports, you'll see that that's exactly correct. It's right around 10% of our economy. Why is it that a consumer economy would be good? This is the question. This is kind of goes to the basis. Well, what are we consuming? That's the big one. What are we consuming?
I had breakfast this morning.
Yeah, and who did you pay for that breakfast?
How
many American companies?
The grocery store.
Yeah, and how many American companies got paid for your breakfast?
Mostly American companies. I don't import a lot of food from China.
Right. When you are buying vehicles, when you're buying computers, when you're buying, you go down the list. Even if you're buying computers that are manufactured overseas, you're still buying from an American company.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of consumers consume something. If we didn't make enough for our own consumption to be profitable, it would be dangerous. But as long as we're making a huge profit on our own consumption, that is a sustainable model. It means that we're not dependent on the rest of the world for our success.
You know, China and Germany are notably countries whose economies are highly dependent upon exports. And that means, for example,
China has just moved into the net import role in the last year.
They're still a net importer. They are definitely a net importer, but they're importing raw materials and they're exporting, and they're starting to import a lot of finished goods now. But still, if the United States suddenly stopped buying stuff, the United States and Europe, for example, suddenly got mad at China and says, we're not going to buy anything more from you. Now, first off, we couldn't.
Yeah, well, if
we did, wreck our economy.
Our economy would be in shambles. Yeah, that's for
sure. But the point is, were we to do so, the Chinese economy would collapse and they would have chaos and you'd have literally hundreds of millions. You'd have a population in China out of work and very angry and not having any place to get food. That is larger than the population of the United States.
Yeah. Their migrant population in China, this is something people are relatively unaware of. The migrant population of China is larger than the population of the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. And when this is great because people they know what is the most populous nation on the planet. People know that. And sometimes they even know the second most. Do you know the second most populous nation on the planet? Caller?
India.
Yeah, India. What's the third?
I can't say. Indonesia?
Nope. The United States of America. So when you think of the size differential between China and the United States, and we're the third most populous, but they have a larger migrant population than we have as a population. They have a working population that dwarfs us. Now, each of them is nowhere near as educated or as productive or as effective or as innovative as we are. But they have been working for years, many, many years, decades, to move to a consumer-driven economy because they saw it worked. That's what we're really afraid of when we see technology leaking and so on, because if they go to a consumer-driven economy and they take our technology to do it, they're not dependent on us. We're only dependent on them.
One of the driving factors in China, well, the driving factor in China, is avoiding chaos, avoiding disruption, avoiding warlordism, because it's still in the memory of the older people when they were a disunited country following World War II that was in perpetual civil war with warlords trying to fight, and it was a terrible, basically like Syria is today. And they are really scared about something. I mean, they're really, really, really sincerely afraid of the fact that we have a technological edge over them in most areas, and they are dependent upon buying things from us. For example, they don't make very many airliners in China, but they need the airliners to get around, and so they have to buy them either from Airbus or from Boeing, and principally they were buying them from Boeing, and they've got contracts, and we'll see how that works out. But the bottom line to it is, they are extremely paranoid about being dependent upon the United States for survival.
And we've just magnified that paranoia, massively magnified that paranoia, by instituting a trade war. They are now, if you can believe the popularity polls, and some of them are pretty good third-party polls, the popularity rating for Xi is through the roof. And minus the scandal going on in Canada, Trudeau's popularity is really, really high. And the reason is because they have an outside attacker. When someone says a trade war, well, who instigated the war? And we can say there were lots and lots and lots and lots of little skirmishes where the Chinese were stealing stuff from us. But they've been going on for decades. It's really hard for us to say, when there wasn't a big new one out of the blue, for us to say, that's the reason, that one right there. We don't have a single reason. They do. And that, in the public opinion, is far more valuable than look at all of these dribs and drabs of little things that the Chinese have been doing. You've heard us say many times on the air, we don't like that. We should have been ramping up slowly pressure on China over a long period of time to say, you've got to stop that. And then if they don't, you ramp it up higher. And if they do, you ramp it down. We don't have the ramp down here. We didn't do a gradual ramp up. It was just 0 to 60, bam, and then we're ready to go to 120 at the next bam. That caused a great deal of paranoia there. It's, you know, we talked last hour about the Germans also being paranoid about us. The British are paranoid about us. The French are paranoid about us because we've just instituted a worldwide trade war with no warning. We just did it. And we're experiencing some difficulties in the United States on the business side of things, prices going up, prices going down, what's happening, and they're experiencing it harsher.
I want to change the subject. Go ahead, caller. Do you have some more questions?
I just wanted to say one last thing real quick, and I'll hang up. I feel like amongst the people I meet are a lot of hardcore Trump supporters, and they really bought into a lot of the stuff about, you know, manufacturing base being eroded in the United States, mm-hmm. and the fear around that. But then I started really looking up some of the statistics. And actually, you know, I was surprised to find that the United States still accounts for 18% of the entire world's manufacturing.
Yeah,
output,
yeah, you're right.
Second only behind China.
We're manufacturing about three times as much as we did in 1984 with about one quarter of the workforce.
Robotics is the thing that they. Yeah. Okay. And that's a really good comment you made there at the end, because I want to address something that was raised on the show here, I guess a couple of months ago, about the Rockwall Alcoa plant and why it shut down. So I went back and did extensive research on
aluminum
that thing.
Stuff. Yeah.
And it shut down gradually, one line at a time over a period of time, and went back and read what Alcoa said and what the union said. And what the economists have said and what commentators have said, it really boiled down to something very simple. It had nothing to do with the price of aluminum.
No, not
at
all.
It had to do with the fact that the Rockwall plant was in Rockwall for one reason. There was a huge lignite coal deposit under Rockwall. And they need a lot of electricity to make aluminum, and so they built a power plant. The power plant was built there. It didn't belong to Alcoa. It belongs to Lucent, by the way, who, by the way, just shut it down.
Yeah.
And the point is that when Lucent took over, when the Texas Power and Light broke up and Lucent took over and with a leveraged buyout, they raised the price of power to the Alcoa plant. And all of a sudden, it's no longer profitable to make aluminum at the Alcoa plant, because the electricity costs are too high, and they made a big deal about it at the time. And Lucent said, "Yeah, but we got to do this." And the reason is
coal's more expensive than natural gas.
Coal's more expensive, and the price of and so while Kella said, "You know, this place is around the country and outside the country where natural gas is being used to generate the electricity, and we can make aluminum a lot less expensively there and thereby maintain our profit margin or increase our profit margin." And they did a big write-off, a big financial write-off to shut the aluminum plant down here. And they laid off a lot of people. And it was unpleasant, but it didn't have anything to do. I'm sure it had something to do with the price of aluminum. Everything has to do with the price of the finished product. But Alcoa is making just as much as aluminum as they made before. They're just making it cheaper in other plants because they have cheaper power sources. And it really boiled down to something. It had nothing to do, and the raising of the cost of aluminum in the United States by imposing tariffs did not increase the number of people working in the United States at aluminum plants. That's one of the things that really shocked me. And the reason is the people who were buying the aluminum stopped buying so much aluminum from the plants because the price went up.
Yeah.
They're trying to find alternatives. They're making them out of plastics. They're trying, and it's a gradual process. One of the reasons that in the year since the tariffs have been put into effect, our balance of trade deficit has gone up tremendously in the year since the tariffs were put into effect. And the tariffs, and it's complicated to follow it back, but when you follow it back, you realize it is the tariffs that caused this. The dollar, because of the tariffs, this is really weird. The dollar rose and is still up about between 7 and 9%, depending on how you measure it, from a year ago. You put a 10% tariff on aluminum, and the value of the dollar goes up nearly 10%, and the end result is that imported aluminum has effectively the same price as it had a year ago. If the president threw a 25% tariff on the cost like he did on steel, he would do the same thing. The dollar would rise again, but what we would see is our exports fall off even more dramatically, because then the things that are made in the United States become too expensive to sell overseas.
Yeah.
And the dollar, it's a double whammy, because not only are we having to pay more for the raw material, but the dollar's gone up.
Yeah, and this comes back to infrastructure again. It's a different form of infrastructure. It's not highway stuff. We have a real problem when it comes to steel and aluminum, and it isn't steel and aluminum. It's we don't mine the ingredients for those metals anymore. The iron mines in the United States are almost all shut down. So we're importing well over 90% of our iron. We're only importing 27% of our steel. For the first time last year, since the 1970s. the majority of the aluminum in use is recycled in the United States. It isn't because we've had this big push for recycling. It's because it's expensive to import aluminum. So we're recycling. And that's what it comes back to, is that if you want to enforce recycling, make the cost of the thing that you're throwing away more. Pay people more money for it.
Now, did you read, though, that cans recycling is no longer economical, and as a result, they're just piling up in yards?
Yeah, and the reason is very, very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
The paint, the logo on the can is a plastic that makes it not pure aluminum. Aluminum generally needs to have a little bit of copper in it to be pliable so it doesn't shatter on impact. So you put a little bit of copper into aluminum, around 1%. It's not a big deal. And that's what the cans are made of, about 1% copper, 99% aluminum, and about 2% plastic paint, which is parts of it do not burn.
Mm-hmm.
They stay in the metal, and so you have to get the metal to a hotter temperature, which is more expensive, to refine that out as slag.
Yeah, and the fact that more and more soft drink containers are made out of plastic.
Yeah.
So they're not, there's no market for the recycled, that particular kind of aluminum. And the other thing is, we make cars out of aluminum now. And because we make cars out of aluminum, we make transmissions out of aluminum, we make engine blocks out of aluminum. That is nearly pure aluminum. And it is very profitable. That is very profitable to recycle. It comes in big chunks.
Yeah, you just cut it up, or you have a big enough furnace, you have a big enough kiln, foundry, to take this huge block of aluminum and melt it all at once. You don't have to break it up. You don't have to clear off slag. It's pure.
And so the whole issue with aluminum, very frankly, is the government should stay out of it.
Yeah.
The issue with steel.
I tend to feel that way about
government should stay out of it.
Entire market. If you're going to get into the market as a government, it should be to encourage long-term planning.
Yes.
So if you're going to give a credit for using solar energy, it should be temporary to encourage long-term planning. And when you have a permanent solar energy credit, it stifles innovation. I've talked about this on the air before. We, at the academic level, at the university level, at the corporate level, photovoltaics, that's solar, have made massive leaps forward in the last 20 years. The solar panel that you buy today is not that different than it was 20 years ago. Even though we're up 60% in efficiency in the technology, the plants have to be replaced that manufacture it, and that costs money. It's profitable right now with the tax credits, so why should they spend the money so that, you know, they're going to take a big hit to their bottom line for the next several years on this plant where their competitors are still making it and they can charge at a lower price because they don't have this big upfront investment. When the government gets involved, it should be targeted and it should be based on initiating long-term investments in a positive direction. So when I'm saying tariffs don't work well, that stifles innovation. That's the same as if you're the home team requiring the visiting team to tie one hand behind their back. That does not make your home team play better. It does make them win more games. Long term, that's a temporary solution, or you're just going to get worse. And if it's not a temporary thing, and we don't know if there's an end date on this, that means that our productivity will fall because of the tariffs.
Well, in the photovoltaics and the wind power, I read an interesting justification for the tax credits.
There's a lot of justifications,
And no, the justification isn't we want to encourage them to do this so much as it is the fact that we got to have the electricity from someplace.
Yeah.
And the common costs, you know, in the commons, where that is a result of the exhaust fumes from and all of the other wear and tear on highways and everything else that involved from coal and natural gas, is borne by the general public. It's borne by the government, in effect. And as a result, if it actually is economically effective to encourage non-polluting power sources to the degree we can, I do agree with you that it distorts the system.
Yeah, it does not invite innovation, except Tesla as a company would not exist today without those credits.
Yep.
And when the credits got dropped at the beginning of this year, they had to lower the price of their cars to match, which cut into their profit margin. They have finally gotten to a place where it's still profitable to make the car without the tax credit. And that means that they are head and shoulders above everybody else. Nobody's going to get that boost from the government if we keep getting rid of the tax credit.
You know, a lot of the information we give here on this program, by the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, presuming today is the 23rd of March where you are. We've handed out a lot of negative information. We've also stated that the leading economic indicators indicate we're not about to have a recession. And by the way, there's another indicator that's even more esoteric, which is the bond yield spread between high grade
and junk
or high yield bonds, which is not spread a whole bunch, which happens before a recession. It spreads out a lot. It hasn't spread. So we've still probably got a year or more before the inevitable recession comes along.
Unless we get a doubling of the tariff, and then all bets are off.
Yeah, but there's a couple of big wild cards here. First off, I want to say the government spending is up, government deficit is up, but it could be a lot worse. Let me tell you why it could be a lot worse. We increased spending by 9%. The government increased in spending last year by 9%, mm-hmm. but they've only spent about half of it.
If we'd done that in a recession, it may have been stimulus.
Good.
If you'd done this in a kind of mediocre economy, it probably would not have been good at all. Doing it when we did it with the tariffs and the spending, it's like we're going to get hurt from it, but it's like the least pain.
It's driving along the tax cuts and the increased spending while imposing the tariffs is like driving along, pressing down the accelerator and the brake at the same time.
Right. Let's now, lower taxes and raise taxes is what we said.
Here's why the government has been unable to spend all the money that was allocated. The infrastructure won't support it. In other words, they go out and say, we'd like to do this, whatever it may be, and build this stuff or encourage more barracks building on Fort Hood or something like that. And they have this much money that they're willing to pay for it. And the people say, well, we'd love to do that, but we just can't find truck drivers to move all the stuff here. So we're going to have to delay this and charge you more. And the government says, no, we don't want to do that. And it's the very infrastructure issue we were talking about is one of the reasons that the government hasn't spent as much money as they thought they were going to be able to spend, which, by the way, helps because we haven't run up as much of a deficit as we thought we were going to run up. But
that if we just spent all the money right now, it would run the deficit up, but it's not being spent, so it hasn't been borrowed. It is not like the money's sitting in a pot somewhere and hasn't been spent. And the money has to be borrowed before it can be spent, and hasn't been borrowed yet.
Here's one of the great ironies. When the military budget was increased by, was it $500 billion last year? And a lot of that was going to go in build stuff. And there have been two problems with that. Number one, the first problem that hit was, let's build some more tanks, and here's how much we'll pay for them. But we put a tariff on steel at the same time, which makes the tanks more expensive, and the government says we won't pay that much because we didn't plan on paying an extra 25%
right.
for the steel and the tanks. So they're having to renegotiate. And then the second problem hit, and here is, you want an irony. This is one of the big ironies. These projects that this extra Defense Department money was aimed at last year are on the hit list for the border wall.
Yeah.
Which means the government has said, nope, we had this contract all ready to go and we wanted to hire people and we wanted to build stuff, but we can't do it until somebody makes up their mind what part of the money is going to be taken away from building stuff on military installations and building new weapons and all of these things that might be a stimulus to the economy. Everything's on hold because the Defense Department and the President have not determined which of these projects are going to take the money and redirect to the border. So everything, all of this stuff is coming together at the same time.
Yeah, and I'm going to do a little segue here, but it's not a complete turn away from this subject. What we're dealing with is a government in conflict with itself in direct relationship to the economy. When big purchases are planned, it's not just planned at the top level. It goes all the way down to the bottom. You brought up the wall. I'm going to read off some numbers here.
This is two
illegal alien apprehensions by month and by year. So 1.67 million. When do you think I'm talking about?
I don't know.
The year 2000.
I know there's been a surge recently.
1.26 million, 2001. I'm going to pull forward a few years. It's steadily declining over those years. There's a couple of bumps up. Down in 2007, we were at 876,000.
Which means that it's dropped by half.
Right. 2008 was at 700,000. This is straight from the United States Border Patrol. I recommend you look up any numbers that you hear people quoting. So 2009, we were down to 550,000, which is a third. 2010, we were at 463,000.
Wow. 2011, so we went from 1.6 million to 400,000.
2011, we were at 340,000. So that was the bottom. 2012, we were up to 360,000. 420,000 in 2013. 2014 was almost back up to 500,000. 2015, we're down to 337,000. What happened there? Well, Mexican jobs were doing really well. That's also the same year that the immigrant population stopped being majority Mexican. So 2016, we're at 415,000. 2017, 310,000. And then last year, 404,000. We've recently had a spike in the end at the end of 2018 and beginning of 2019. There's some delay in other data when it comes to who's coming in, where they're coming from. But what is very clear is that asylum requests are the majority of illegal immigrants at this point. The law of the land, the courts have ruled on this, is that if you are standing on U.S. soil and you speak to a government official, you may ask for asylum no matter how you got there. That's the law. That's a congressionally passed law. This brings into question the entire purpose of the wall, because the wall cuts off huge chunks of U.S. soil. The majority of the 400,000 people, the majority of those people are seeking asylum. All they have to do is be on the soil, which is still on the other side of the wall. Now all they have to do is ask. And there's pictures of this, of people lining up at gates in the wall. Families, because family units are a big deal. In the early 2000s, before the Great Recession.
Man, I didn't think of that.
Families were not what was coming. It was workers. They were coming to participate in the real estate boom of building all these houses that people weren't actually going to live in, but they all had loans on them, which led to the Great Recession. So we were paying them lots of money to come and build houses that nobody was going to live in, which doesn't make any sense. But they were going back home, and that's what we saw. You know, we see these numbers within the 300,000s being detained at the border. More than that by three times left during those years. We had a net outflow of illegal aliens and detentions, a net removal during the Great Recession. Then we had a little bit of trickle back, but they had good jobs in Mexico at this point. They had used NAFTA to have us be paying them money through a legal system. Now, and this is an interesting thing, Latin American, and that includes Mexico, as strange as that is because it's North America rather than South America, but we're looking
still
at
Latin America.
Spanish-speaking countries, and to some extent Portuguese, but more Spanish-speaking. We're looking at El Salvador, Guatemala, and Venezuela as the number one places, or number three places.
For what?
For immigration and by far the highest family unit.
Origin of immigration. Illegal immigration.
Right. And those people are asking for asylum. So if you think back to
the Irish wave, the Polish wave, the African wave. They were leaving places that were at war. And they came to a place where they had to work really, really hard, and they were happy to be here so that they could work really, really hard and keep what they were earning and not have this last thing. Venezuela, El Salvador, and Guatemala, the majority of the people that are coming are indigenous. They have been in the same probably 5 square miles. Their family goes back there thousands of years. And they're leaving to come to the United States, not because they want to take our jobs, but because their neighbor was just murdered in front of them. So illegal immigration is bad. The immigration system that we have is conflicted. It says illegal immigration is bad, but if you're here for asylum, it's okay. That's conflicted. We got to get that fixed. The wall might be great if we figure out how to do it to prevent illegal immigration, but if the majority of illegal immigration can walk right through the wall, we're not helping anything.
They don't have to walk through the wall. This is the point.
They just knock on the door.
No, wait, no. You said something that was
detention. I should say. Not majority of illegal immigrants.
You said something that caused a light bulb to go on in my head. If we build the wall across Texas the way it's supposed to be, the way the government has proposed, we will put large chunks of U.S. territory on the south side of the wall.
Yeah.
Which means there will be no. Cross the Rio Grande, which is easy to do.
Yeah, and then you just stand there.
And you're on American soil, and
now you get
say,
asylum.
I want asylum. You pick up your cell phone, and you call the immigration service, and you say, I want asylum. I'm standing on American soil. The law says you can ask for asylum at that point.
That's right. And what happens
and there's
to—
there's no longer any guarding of that territory.
No. Now, if we had prevented them from crossing the river, they couldn't ask for asylum. I'm not recommending that, just as a side note. I think that people coming for asylum are a very different category than your typical illegal immigrant. This is not profit motive. This is survival motive. How we deal with that has to be made clear. And this is something that's we've been arguing about this politically for decades, many decades. Ronald Reagan was arguing about it. George H.W. Bush was arguing about it. Bill Clinton was arguing about it. George W. Bush was arguing about it. Obama was arguing about it. And now Trump is very forcefully arguing about it. The reality is that we're split as a nation, but we've made zero progress to figure out what we're going to do. So we have a completely dysfunctional system where the law says two completely opposing things. You're not allowed to come on U.S. soil or we will arrest you. But if you ask for asylum, we're going to un-arrest you. If you're a family and you're traveling by foot from Guatemala, that's a conflicted signal.
What we did with the Mexican labor immigration system worked, which is to say, we set up, and there's a name for them, I've forgotten it, a zone. We agreed, we got a treaty with Mexico, and there's a zone on the other side of the border.
It's an economic something zone.
Where U.S. companies can set up shop, manufacture cars or whatever, using Mexican labor, pay them legally, pay them a reasonable wage, bring the car back in the United States without an import tariff. And now that's counted in the balance of trade, but it's still there's no import tariff if the car is assembled within so many miles of the border. And what that did in effect, and Jake was just quoting the numbers, it took us from 1.6 million coming in to 300,000 or 400,000 coming in, and at least the ones that were being apprehended. And
this is
a winning operation. So the issue is if the 300,000 or 400,000 that are coming in now are because of what's going on in their native countries, then we put pressure on those native countries to stop doing the thing that's causing them to leave and come to the United States.
The pressure we're putting on Venezuela is going to cause more people to come. It may be good long term, but we should expect this. This is very, very normal stuff for the history of the world. If you see a bad situation in a foreign country with people killing each other because they want each other's food, expect immigration to be higher. Just a simple statement there.
I wouldn't say that our activities against them are causing that, because we're trying to ship food in there.
And we are, but yeah, and that is true.
But there's, anyway, you are listening to Person Wealth Coach.
We've got some commercials.
It's 11:42, and our telephone number here is 254-773-1400, but we do need to do some commercials and keep the folks at Town Square Media happy and keep us on the air.
Yeah.
So we'll be back after these important words from Town Square Media sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if you want to talk about anything to do with economics or investing or things of that ilk. By the way, if I could.
You could.
I'd like to talk about the fact that we, well, not just us, but surveyed by the Wall Street Journal this month of leading economists in the United States. Concluded that there's a 50% roughly 50% probability of a recession in 2020. About a third of them, on the other hand, about 33% say no, it won't be till 2021. So, but the vast majority of economists who've been studying this for many years agree, and the indicators are all there that we're due to have a recession in the next couple of years, and the bond market certainly seems to be agreeing right now. So what should you do about that? Well, in essence, if you've got a good cash reserve and you've got what we call, in other words, good dry powder, a good reserve that you can carry through about an 18-month downturn, if you're doing systematic withdrawals, then nothing. If you've got a well-diversified portfolio, the issue is to ride through, not bail out. And there's going to be, this is going to come. There will be, I'm confident there will be a bear market. It won't be too terribly severe. It'll be a typical cyclical bear market. I'm confident that the news media will scream bloody murder about how the world's going to come to an end. You're going to lose all your money. The key as we move forward is to get your mindset on the fact that you're going to ride through this. And how can you say, why shouldn't you just bail out now that it's supposedly the top or near the top? And then get back in at the bottom. Well, the answer is twofold. Number one, we don't know that this is the top. There's a lot of scenarios we can play out that says the economy will accelerate again this year and wind up at the end of the year much better off than it is, and the stock market much better off than it is. And that's not something you want to miss. And the second thing is there's no way of telling when these things are going to start and when it's just a head fake. I mean, a lot of people thought we were entering into a bear market in December, and then we came right back out of it again. So if you'd bailed out in December thinking, oh, my goodness, it's going to drop, it's going to be terrible, and then you realize now that's not so, and you get back in, you buy in higher than you got out, which is a terrible thing to do. And the reason that you don't want to try to time the market is because literally nobody has been able to successfully do it over a long period of time. Some people get lucky and they get out at the top and they get in at the bottom once. And they became headlines all over the country. This guy is uber smart and he's forms a hedge fund. And there's a guy named Atkins, yeah, that did that. There's a series of people who formed hedge funds who got out at the top, got in at the bottom at some major.
Ackerman.
There's a bunch of them that have done that. But there's something pretty common about them after that. They fail miserably.
There was a headline in the Wall Street Journal last week about Ackerman, about him slowly stepping out of the scene after he's completely underperformed the market for the last 5 years.
And if you don't believe that, you just start taking a look at mutual funds that claim that to be able to do that, and you'll see among the worst producers, not a lot of them left out there because most of them have gone out of business because nobody has ever successfully been able to be a good market timer. And if nobody and people with millions of dollars to spend on overhead and research and charts and numbers and everything else, and they can't do it, the fact that one of us thinks we can do it is worse than foolish. It is just not going to happen. So the issue is, and this is, again, one of those things that through history we've seen very clearly, if you're able to be in a cash reserve, short-term bond position where you can ride through a bear market, your best route is to have a well-diversified portfolio and just stick with it. just stick with it. We've had some very successful people. We've seen some very successful investors over the years. And I almost uniformly compliment them, and they talk about how wonderful they sometimes talk about how wonderful we are or how wonderful the manager was that helped them get through this. And I say, no, you're the ones that are wonderful. And they say, why? And I said, you didn't bail out in a bear market. I have never seen a highly successful investor who did market timing. And I've been doing this 36 years now, and I've seen a lot of people try it and fail. I've seen a lot of people who come to us with money that they've been very, very successful with, or their parents have been very, very successful with. We can look at the history. Nobody who bails out in a bear market that I've ever seen has done well because they did so. It's the people who just stick with it and stay in there. Warren Buffett doesn't try to time the market, and he's arguably the most successful investor in the 21st century for sure. John Templeton, arguably the best investor in the 20th century, never tried to time the market and spoke against it. So the issue is, yeah, there's a bear market coming. Do we know when? No. Do we know what you should do about it? Yes, and that is have enough reserves that you don't have to tap into your equity positions and into your stock positions during the bear market, and then have your portfolio be well diversified.
Fantastic. So our long term, and this is something we haven't said, we've talked a lot about the recession and the near term. Our longer term, when we look out 10 years out.
Yes, talk about that.
This is the shining light at the end of the tunnel, and the tunnel's not that long. This recession, we don't expect it to be that bad. We expect it to be relatively short and not painless, but relatively painless, particularly compared to the Great Recession. Afterwards, we're seeing a repeat of history. The tech jobs are the size of the tech industry is growing. How is this a repeat of history? We didn't have Alphabet and Google and Facebook and Apple and all of those things in history. So how is this a repeat? We had Ford and we had General Motors and we had Stanley Steamer and we had the railroads.
And John Deere and McCormick.
Right, and Caterpillar. And those were tech. Those were the big tech. And if you go way back to the roaring 20s, we had just been through a tough economic period in 1907, followed by a major war that lasted longer and killed a lot of people, where we've had some relatively, on the scale of war, minor wars, but that have lasted a great deal of time. So there's some similarities there. There's a rhyme to the history. In the 20s, what caused it to be the roaring 20s was the great number of highly educated people that were going from not very profitable jobs to tech jobs that were very profitable. They were building, and manufacturing jobs, they were building the tractors.
Manufacturing was the tech at the time.
Yeah, they were building and designing and manufacturing the parts to build these new items. Automobiles were new, and they were centered in the United States. Tractors were relatively new. Again, majority built, United States. So we built not just for ourselves, but for the world. And for those people that left the wheat fields and corn fields to go work in a tractor facility, in the Great Depression, they may have lost their job, but they had skills that were in demand. The people that waited, that stayed in the corn and the wheat fields, lost their jobs when the tractors showed up, what those other people were making. What caused the Roaring Twenties happened before that. The Roaring Twenties was this huge, innovative frenzy that was taking place. And we can see that so clearly on the horizon. When people talk about automation taking jobs, that's 10 years out. Before that happens, people have to build the thing that's going to automate it. And if you know you've got 10 years into the future of building things that will be extremely lucrative for you, before things might not be so lucrative, it changes how you treat your assets during that period. So for the next 10 years, we have this glowing thought about what the U.S. economy is going to do, what the market as a whole is going to do, and how do you avoid
the pitfall at the end of that, when the jobs are replaced in large part by machines. And we'll see that over the next 5 or 6 years in truck driving. It'll be slow because it's not cost effective to buy all new tractor trailers everywhere and just dump the old ones.
And there's a lag that's going to be built into this.
Right. It's very much like, here's a good one. In the 1990s, when you called and when you picked up the phone and you hit zero, what happened? You hit zero and you spoke to a...
Well, actually, I was thinking about the 1980s or 70s, but yeah, operator.
You talked, yeah, and then in the early 1990s, you talked to an operator.
Right.
The decade of the 90s saw the operators as humans disappear. So it took about a decade for that to happen, and you didn't hear about mass layoffs. It was a slow replacement of people.
Well, actually, mass layoffs came, as you mentioned, later. There used to be big phone banks in Killeen.
Right. Exactly.
For Sallie Mae.
Mm-hmm.
And they all those jobs disappeared. Computers now deal with that. You know, and the other thing is, if you call a business today, it's very rare that a human being answers the phone.
Yeah, we take a lot of pride in our humans.
And instead, you have a computer answering the phone. It says, press 1 if you want this, and press 2 if you want that. And
speaks in a different language and tells you to push buttons that are in a different language, so you're not even sure what button you're not supposed to push.
So, well, I don't know about that, but they...
It depends on the language.
If a human being is answering the phone, they're in India or Pakistan or China or something.
Yeah.
But the point is that these things are changing and the acceleration is going to happen. But the big thing is we're going to go through a recession. The recession will cause a reset, as it does.
And it's well-needed.
And on the other side of it, we expect an economic boom that is going to be quite impressive. But it's very important, if you're preparing for that boom, if you're young or if you know somebody that's young, that they be very careful. And the president made a very good speech about student debt, about the fact that colleges are just trying to sell whatever they can sell, whatever somebody wants to get, and they'll let them run up tens of thousands of dollars of debt to get a course in advanced basket weaving or art history or something that they
right.
can't get a job for. That is a problem. We have a society where technical skills are desperately needed. And the idea of going out and borrowing a bunch of money, and by the way, older people are doing this too, to get education from flaky institutions that then they cannot get a job with is an ongoing problem. Just be aware that we have a free market out there, and it's buyer beware when you do that. But it's crucial to think about what skills are going to be needed going forward, and we don't have enough time to talk more about that.
I think the biggest skill you need is innovation. The ability to change your skills on demand, to be able to learn is what you need.
Right, and there are certain areas, for instance, technicians in the medical area, electronic technicians are crucial.
And
anyway, you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to contact us off the air locally, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We have lots of goodies on there. We've got recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. We've got newsletters going back lots of years. If you wonder how we did in our predictions and recommendations, you can go back and look. You can email us through that system, too, or directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. As I said last hour, we enjoy this time. It's probably the longest time we get to talk one-on-one with each other throughout the week, and we love that you're listening. So thank you.